You're with SBS Radio.
Joël Glas is journaliste en reist al jaren door de outback van Australië, waar ze onder meer foto's neemt en vaak mensen tegenkomt met bijzondere verhalen. Vandaag het verhaal van Eugène Blom, Eugene, die als 10-jarig jochie met zijn familie en 5 broers en zusters naar Australië vanuit Arnhem emigreerde. En niet zomaar ergens in Australië, nee, het gezin vestigde zich notabene in Alice Springs. Eugene heeft in de loop der jaren een intensieve hobby ontwikkeld, waarbij hij historische foto's namaakt die vanaf precies dezelfde plek genomen zijn als het origineel. Op een wandeling langs de Todd River en Anzac Hill in de buurt van Alice Springs vertelt hij in dit eerste deel vooral over zijn Nederlandse roots en hoe hij het vond, een jochie uit Arnhem, om opeens in het Alice Springs van de 70e jaren te wonen.
Eugene, tell me, what are we up to first? Where are we?
Oh, we're walking along the bank of the Todd River, Alice Springs.
You're a member of a big family, 6 kids.
And you
came here in the early 70s when you were 10. Did you speak Dutch at home for a long while? Or?
Not at all.
Not at all?
We came here and wanted to be Aussies. Mate, there's a kid in my class and Mum would describe them as Eerpelzakken. You know, like potato bags, you know. And so their elastic grey shorts were already down to the top of their knees, but they would let them slide down till you could see the crack of their bum, and the shorts were over your knees, you know. And we arrived from Holland in our hot pants, you know, like seriously, these really tight little, you could, yeah, like, you know, they were tiny. And white legs sticking out, and all the kids here have brown legs and they all wore Jesus boots, you know, those strappy sandals. Yeah, they call them Jesus boots. And we just wanted to be Aussies and we looked so stupid because we had these silly little shorts. And the moment I got proper school shorts like everyone else, I was dragging them down. I wanted to show my crack like the other kids. But yeah, it was just down here at the bottom of the hill. Because we saw a slideshow before we left Holland in Arnhem. And they showed this hill next to the school. I said, is that next to the school? Can you go up there? He said, oh, yeah, probably. Bullshit. Bloody nuns, they would never let us up here. You couldn't go out of the bloody yard. And there's a hill there to climb, and you couldn't even go there, just across the road. So unfair. But, yeah, that was the time of dust storms coming over the hill. You imagine a dust storm 3 times the height of that hill. So that's only a third of the dust storm. Then 2/3 higher would be this dust storm that would build up and up and up and up, and then whoomp, it had hit the town. Dust storm! And you'd hear clack, 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 windows shutting. Everyone shutting their windows because the sand would just come in through the windows. So, and you'd also have snakes under the door, you know, those draft excluders. Towels, chuck them under the doors because you'd be shoveling it out if you didn't. So the first few years, just these enormous dust storms all over this town. So, like, for us, it was the Wild West. It was, like, just so exciting. Yeah, best thing ever. Doesn't rain here.
Did you have many, Aboriginal friends?
Yes, the convent school did have some Aboriginal kids in the class. But, you know, it's only later that you realise that it's a complex situation. You know, there are lots of kids that weren't coming to the school. There were kids out bush that didn't have schooling like we did. But yeah, we grew up thinking, well, you know, Aboriginal kids in the class, it's all right. There were Aboriginal kids that we went hunting budgerigars with. You'd take a pillowcase, somebody would drop us off at Emily Gap with pillowcases and a tomahawk. You climb trees and you chop the hollow logs until either the budgie flew out into the pillowcase, or you could chop the hollow log till you could reach in and get the baby ones. And then we had to go home and build an aviary. So we built an aviary and we had budgerigars in our aviary. You know. Yeah. Probably all illegal now.
Do you have any Dutch things that you still think that you have in you?
Yeah, there are times that I think, like, I was surprised in my work life to find that even as a young fella, I'd be speaking up at meetings with the chief executive or, you know, big bosses there, and everyone would sort of look at me and go, why are you talking? You know, you're not supposed to say anything at meetings. But I always felt, no, you have to speak up because, you know, your opinion might be important or you might have a good idea that they can use. So, yeah, you speak up. And I used to speak up all the time. It was only later I realised that that's a very Dutch thing to do. Nobody taught me that. My work life was very separate from anything that I learned from my parents or any Dutch adults. So maybe that is a bit of a Dutch thing. But yeah, and now I go back to Holland. I don't even try to speak Dutch too much anymore. I mean, I fall into Dutch when I get there. But, you know, when we're at a restaurant or a cafe and I'm trying to translate the menu, words that I don't normally use, and my wife says, what is it? Oatsmeter. Yeah, so, you know, my little 10-year-old Dutch brain starts thinking oatsmeter. Throw out. Oh, no, it's a fried egg. But I'm not sure what it's with. I think it's roast beef or something, I was saying. And by that time, the waitress had arrived, yeah. But everything changes, doesn't it? I went back after being away 10 years. I was about 20. I went back, and the church that was built when I was 5 was already knocked down and new flats over the top of it. The school that I went to was like an emergency school because the population was expanding so quickly. It had totally changed. The meadows where we went walking every Sunday and flying kites was built in with suburbia. Yeah, it didn't look like the place anymore. And yet, you know, and everything's so small, you know, that sense of you're an adult now. Now you're walking around Lilliput going, were the streets really like that small? Like, how do they get cars up and down? And like, we used to think it was all such a big country, but yeah, no, it's tiny, tiny. And the open space here, you go back and suddenly you realise that, yeah, that's not home anymore, you know? And you come home, every time you come here, you come through that gap. You know, so I had a niece who explained it to me once. She was in the car. She said, that's like your front door, isn't it? And the range is here like arms welcoming you, saying, you're home.
True.
You come from the north through the hills and you see the ranges and you go, yep, home.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is my home, my country. So your when the Aborigines yeah. say my country, you go, yep. Yeah, well, you know what? My kids were born in the Alice Springs Hospital. And in Arunda, the local tribe, that means that you're part of the caterpillar country. So my kids are Yiparin, your kids, no any different. But, you know, I don't know, I'm a bit conflicted about the fact that there are a few, you know, traditional Aborigines left who consider stuff sacred and go, oh, you shouldn't be walking on that hill. And I'm going, mate, I spent my youth walking up and down that hill. I got places that they don't know about. And there are secret places up there I know are so sacred and secret that other old stories start making sense, like the time when my bus driver got shot by a young Aboriginal fella, jumped out from behind Flynn's grave, shot him in his car. He was our bus driver. And and it was horrific for the whole town. And they got some Aboriginal trackers to follow him, and they gave up very quickly. And everyone said, well, you know, what's going on? What's going on? Like, and now it makes total sense. There's a place up there that if you go there, anybody, I don't care what nationality or what religion you are, there's a place. And if I sat you down there, you would go, holy crap, like, this is a really special place. And, you know, no one knows it's here. It's like being in a cubby and overlooking your town through the leaves. Like a treehouse, you know, you imagine a place and no one knows you're there. And you can be there, overlook the town, and here's a place you could stay for 2 weeks and no one would know you were there. And guess what? This guy was missing for 2 weeks. At least I remember them saying, oh, after 2 weeks, where could he be? You know, where would you go? They've blocked all the roads after 2 weeks. And I'm thinking, yep, I know the place where he'd be. And then later, you know, my brother-in-law says, yeah, you know, my father was a minister, and the Aborigines would say to him, no one asked us. We know where he was. I know where he was because it's a sacred place. And you just know. And it's really weird. You can look at it from all angles and think, oh, that's just an interesting rock outcrop.
So,
but if you don't go there, you don't know.
So just for clarity, those trackers stopped because they knew they wouldn't.
There was like there was no way known they were going to take a white fella up the hill and show them that place because that blows it, you know. And, yeah. And already, you know, I can understand from the indigenous perspective, they've already lost so many places. For example, the gap, right? The gap in the range has got a railway through it and a road through it now. Well, before white fellas came, women and children had to cross in a low ridge, lowest part on the saddle over there past Mount John, because that was sacred. Now, all the clefts and cracks in the hill were places where they would store their sacred jeringas. You know, that was really important. Some of them were birthstones, and some represented almost equivalent to a mummy of, you know, some of their ancestors. And if you carried them, you had their power. So if they were a good tracker, then you got the tracker powers. If they were a good fighter, you became the fighter. So, you know, they had their own uses for them at special times for ceremonies, but women and children were not going to go through that gap, ever. That was a sacred place. Now we're using that as a public thoroughfare. And anyway, all the white fellas have raided anything that they thought was secret, because just in case it was worth something. You know, it must be something in our blood that says, if it's secret, find it. And there are times like this particular place I'm thinking of where everything's a human scale, and it's like being in a place that's as big as a house. You could comfortably sit down with 20 people in a circle and be enclosed.
Yep.
In a secret place that no one knows is there.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, that gives you a special feeling of, you know what, this is pretty special. And because it's a secluded place, it happens to trap water, which means there's green growth there, which means that there's lots of wallabies there. So there's tucker and a nice place to camp.
Makes
sense.
And
it's totally secret. And it's that little secret feeling inside you as well that goes, you know what, no one knows I'm here. Yeah. You know, it's really cool.
The cubby house, treehouse feeling.
Yeah. I love those places.
Eugene en Joël lopen nog steeds rond langs de Todd River en Anzac Hill in Alice Springs en ze zijn op zoek naar twee plekken aan de hand van twee foto's van bomen met landschap uit 1947.
And I've got a couple of old pictures from 1947. Well, this is a view of Mount Gillon with a craggly old corkwood tree overhanging it. The other one is a gum tree that's sort of sweeping around in this graceful sort of arch over these rocks. And I'm quite excited about this one because I know this tree and I've been interested in it for a long time. And
okay.
Then online I saw this picture, went, hey, there's that tree. So I found out who this photographer was. And this guy, he went to the First World War when he was about 30.
Mm-hmm.
And then another 30 years later, he's 60 years old and he's a professional photographer. Comes to Alice Springs and he starts taking photos. The interesting story I read about him, he actually wrote an article for the Photography Review magazine or something like that, and he was suggesting that, you know, the last 4 years of the First World War had taught us that things are ephemeral, you know, people blow things up, buildings are demolished, people's lifestyles are ruined, everything changes, and photography is a great way to capture history. So here's a guy with a passion for capturing history who comes to Alice Springs, and he's quite a good photographer. I'm attracted to his pictures because they are full frame negatives, you know, like in the old days, negatives were the same size as a postcard, so you could quickly print off a postcard.
Well, and you're doing something very special with these old photos because you're trying to find the spot where those photos were taken, right?
Yeah.
And then you take another photo of it now.
Yeah.
But not just the picture generally, but exactly the same spot.
Exactly, yes. I like to be really, really precise about it because it's only when it's exact that more facts drop out. You know, if it's approximate, then people have to do too much work in their head to try and line it up. It's very difficult to find trees from old photos. I often have photos from the 1920s even where the Jack Labor, the publican, was a keen photographer, and he'd get his glass plates and, you know, put his silver gelatin emulsion on them and come down the creek or wherever he was going that day and expose a plate, and then he'd make his own prints. And that sort of romantic idea of, you know, people who really care about preparing a photograph and printing it themselves, and then, you know, those photos are kicking around now because they shared them with people, and you find them in other people's collections as well. The postmaster was a keen photographer in the 1890s, and some of his photos end up in other people's collections, and they put them online, and you see them again and again. And these people, it's just like a card collection that people share and swap, you know, what have you got kind of thing.
Dat waren Eugene en Joël. Aanstaande zaterdag zenden we het tweede deel van dit gesprek uit. En dan gaat het over historische ontdekkingsreizigers, beroemde fotografen en natuurlijk de stoffige Outback. Als je ondertussen wat van zijn foto's wilt zien, kun je alvast naar zijn Facebookpagina waar die foto's allemaal op staan. House Elf Adventures heet het.
Tell us what you think. Rate this podcast on iTunes. It helps other people to find us.